Diet Black Podcast is a podcast about true crime, punk rock and gothic music, TV shows and movies, pretty much anything creepy or weird that we decide to discuss. It may contain graphic content, vulgar language, and suggestive themes that may be triggering and or inappropriate for some listeners. Let's be honest, it's gonna contain vulgar language. Now, all opinions are just that, they're opinions. We are not scholars, lawyers, or historians, and by no means do we claim to be experts. And the information that we obtain comes from the internet, and we have no proof that it's fact. So thank you, and enjoy the show. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed that awesome bass riff that I put together for the show.
He's been making noises in the house again.
What?
I was upstairs and doing some work, and the cat and I gave each other looks like, what the hell's going on down there?
A rattler in the house.
He's rattling the house. Even more than the trains that go by.
So today's episode is going to be brought to you by the near 36 ounces of PBR I've already almost drank.
Oh, yeah. It's still daylight, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah. Thanks to the pandemic, we are day drinking. But I am super excited about this episode that I put together.
And I have to say, like, I have been wanting to do this story for a while. And I was like, babe, let's do this. And I haven't had a time to do anything because this is a really busy time for my job, even though, like, I don't even see my job half the time. But I would like to give a big thank you to my partner here who picked it up and ran with it.
Yeah.
So most of tonight is going to be him. I am here for thoughts and prayers, I guess.
Thoughts and prayers brought to you by Screwball.
Screwball. And Bink. I'm going to chime in where I can, but this one's almost all him, so.
Yeah, I mean, we got our bi-weekly, basically, shopping trip done today.
Yeah, we go every 2 weeks, about week and a half to 2 weeks. Stock up on everything we need for the house, and
it's an insanely heavy cart, but
it's all beverages. Liquid because we drink a lot of soda, we drink a lot of Gatorade, and, you know, throw in a couple of things to be healthy, but I like a good green machine once in a while. Keeps the system running.
Literally running. Running out your ass.
I wasn't going to go that far.
Oh, I did.
But I needed some green in my life. Because that's the other thing about quarantine is you don't necessarily get your vegetables as much as you probably should.
No, so we stocked up so we can make a salad. Of course, we're going to wash everything with soap and water, then rinse it down real good.
Remember when we were afraid of romaine lettuce? Wasn't that like an easy time in our lives?
Oh, things have changed. How things have changed.
But, yeah. In the meantime, we got together a pretty good episode for you. So stick with us and educate yourselves.
Yes. So first, I'd like to thank my main source of material for this episode is the plasmatics.com for the amazing bio, which honestly, most of the episode is taken from. But there's no better place than to get the real deal and the actual facts than the band's website. And this one is full of detailed bio. So this might be a little bit of a long one. We're going to try to get through it without taking too much time. But I hope
It's an interesting ride, so stick with it.
Yes, so let's get this bad boy started off. Hey, kids, do you like punk rock?
Yay!
Do you like heavy metal?
Yay!
And do you like explosion?
Only after Green Machine.
Well, do we have a treat for you? Tonight, we are going to talk about one of the most outrageous and influential female singers of all time. Wendy and the Plasmatics can arguably have been the most influential bands to some amazing bands such as L7, the Jenna Torturers, Luna Chicks, Marilyn Manson, Rob Zombie, and even now I can hear her influence in one of our Chicago local bands, Mystery Actions.
All very cool bands. Check out Mystery Actions if you haven't. They're awesome. Their personnel are also awesome. And like definitely influenced by a badass punk chick.
Yes. So, of course, this artist that we're talking about tonight is going to be Wendy O. Williams. Wendy O. Williams and the Plasmatics hit the music scene hard. So hard that they bashed its face in and beat it to a bloody pulp. Wendy has often been called the Queen of Shock Rock, the Metal Priestess, the Queen of Punk, and the Dominatrix of Decibels. Wendy Orlean Williams was an American singer, actress, and performance artist. She was considered the most controversial and radical female singers of her time, and her onstage theatrics included partial nudity, exploding equipment, firing shotguns, and blowing up full-size cars, and also chainsawing guitars in half. She performed her own stunts and videos and often sported her trademark mohawk. She wasn't afraid to attack the system by any means necessary. Making her audience uncomfortable was all part of the game, and she was judge, jury, and executioner. She was an all-around badass bitch.
Badass bitch.
Badass bitch. Now, Wendy was born to Robert F. and Audrey Stauber Williams on May 28th, 1948 in Webster, New York. Yeah, she was a Gemini.
It's my mom's birthday.
Oh.
That's some crazy-ass Gemini energy right there.
So she studied clarinet at the Community Music School program of the University of Rochester's Eastman School of Music, and later was a clarinetist in her high school's concert band. Now, at the age of 6, however, she had her first on-screen debut. It's Howdy Doody time. So she appeared as a tap dancing girl on the Howdy Doody show as a member of its peanut gallery. What? So she attended R.L. Thomas High School in Webster, at least partway through the 10th grade, but left school before graduating. Now, when asked, her schoolmates and teachers recalled her as a quote-unquote shy and pretty girl, an average student who played in the junior high band, paid attention to her hair and clothes, and spoke so softly you had to lean toward her to hear her.
Why, things have changed.
Yeah. So at the age of 16, she left her home and hitchhiked to Colorado, where she earned money by selling crocheted string bikinis.
I mean, hey.
Yeah, I mean. And then she headed to Florida, where she worked as a lifeguard. And then she headed over to Europe, where she worked as a macrobiotic cook in London and as a dancer with a gypsy dancing troupe. You know, I didn't look up what a macrobiotic cook was.
Oh, do you not know?
No.
Oh, like, so I remember macrobiotics. It was like the precursor to like the diet fads. So you could only eat certain foods that were supposed to be very healthy for you.
Right.
And I don't remember the very specifics, but I remember like every woman of a certain age went through the, oh, I'm gonna cook macrobiotic. So basically what they're saying is that she was on the trend to be a healthy food person long before anybody else was even like on the game.
Yeah, and I think a
So
fun fact is she lived as a vegan for years.
yeah, I mean, she didn't eat meat most of her life. She was so healthy living, which you wouldn't tell to look at her, but damn, she took it very seriously.
Now, around this time, she became well acquainted with the law, as she was arrested on multiple occasions for shoplifting and passing counterfeit money.
Oh, I didn't know about the counterfeiting.
Yeah. So in 1976, she arrived in New York City, where she came across a copy of Show Business magazine laying open in the Port Authority bus terminal. In it, she saw an ad that was a casting call for radical artists by radical artist at Yale University graduate Rod Swenson for his experimental film Captain Kink's Theater. She replied to the ad and began performing in live sex shows. Now, she later appeared in Gail Palmer's adult film Candy Goes to Hollywood. Yeah. Now, she was also a performer on a parody of gong shows where she would shoot ping pong balls across the set out of what? Her vagina.
Oh, I thought they only did that in Thailand.
Apparently not. In the 70s, they did it in New York City. And she fucking. I mean, could you just imagine that? Like, Wendy O's just like fucking like on like some stirrups or something, and she's just like, boo! Just shooting ping pong balls out of her
Remember that
vag.
scene from Priscilla, Queen of the
Oh, God.
Desert?
Now, by 1977, her and Swenson, Ron Swenson, became her manager and recruited her to join his newly formed punk rock band, Plasmatics. Wendy and Rod began auditioning potential band members in 1977, and in July of 1978, the Plasmatics gave their first public performance at what would later become the Rock Shrine CBGB on New York's Bowery. So they were one of the first bands to like blow that venue out of the water,
Yep.
which is amazing. Now, the earliest version of the band was a three-piece put together with a strong emphasis on visuals. And they quickly realized that the group needed another guitarist to hold the group together musically, and that guitarist was Wes Beach, who was then added to the group at that time. He ended up being a staple throughout all of their recordings. Now, from its conception, the band was designed to assault the status quo at every level. Their favorite targets were hypocrisy, sexism, and American consumerism, whose icons, TVs, and automobiles, which Wendy would symbolically destroy on the stage. Now, in addition to wielding a sledgehammer at TVs and other consumer objects, she often used a chainsaw to cut guitars in half. Especially, this actually started when they would perform their most iconic song, Butcher Baby. Oh, Butcher Baby, they're gonna take you away! This established in no uncertain terms that this was a woman who was not to be taken as passive, submissive, or that they had any intentions at all of making people comfortable.
No
No.
comfort.
Now, from their initial gigs at CBGB's, Wendy and the Plasmatics took the New York Underground by storm. From playing a single weekday nights, they moved quickly to playing repeated stands of 4 nights straight with 2 sold-out shows each night. Lines stretched around the block and bringing more fans into CBGB during this time than any other band in its history. The group quickly outgrew CBGB's, though, and because there were no intermediate rock venues to play in Newark at the time, Rod made a deal to book a then little-known polka hall called Irving Plaza from the Polish War veterans who ran it. The sold-out crowds Wendy and the band drew there helped put Irving Park on the map and launch it into a path of becoming a major established rock venue in New York.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, if you want to go see a good indie band in New York City, you go to Irving Plaza. So
Yeah.
they did that for you. You're welcome.
Now, having now caught the full attention of anyone who was anyone in the entertainment world in New York City, Wendy and the band were now on their way to headlining the Palladium Theater, the first group in history to do so at full ticket prices without a major label recording contract. So, I mean, they did this shit just by the seat of their pants.
Completely on their own. DIY as fuck.
Yes. Now, they were despised by the rock establishment, which they assaulted with every turn. Wendy Williams and the Plasmatics were so far ahead of their time in so many ways that it's hard to know where to begin. They synthesized punk and metal before it was cool to do so. They used chainsaws and other noises pulled through amplifiers, and in their stage shows was second to none. Now, following a series of singles and EPs put out from 1978 to 79 on the home-owned Vice Squad Records, New Hope for the Wretched, which was issued by Stiff Records in the UK in the 1980, was their first full Plasmatics album ever released. It contains a number of early Plasmatics classics such as Butcher Baby, Corruption, Living Dead, Concrete Shoes, and Sometimes I, among others. Now, from the shooting of the cover to the recording itself and the tour that followed New Hope, as with almost every Plasmatics Wendy O project, it was filled with drama and challenge. Now, Stiff had brought in former Rolling Stones producer Jimmy Miller to add production interest to the project, but his heroin problem left him incapacitated from the beginning and nearly torpedoed the album. The record company removed him from the project, calling on Rod, along with Ramones engineer Ed Statham, to salvage the album from tracks recorded in less than an ideal way, with the awesome album cover showing Wendy in a white Cadillac in a swimming pool.
Yeah, we were watching a documentary about the whole project, and they said that they had to basically pay off a nudist colony to use their swimming pool for the shoot. And the day that they were supposed to shoot, it rained all day, so they couldn't get the shoot the first day. So they had to keep the crane that they were using to lift up the Cadillac for another day and pay a whole nother set of fees so they could dunk a Cadillac into the pool of a nudist colony, stick Wendy O. Williams on the cover of the sinking Cadillac, and get the shot, in which you can see the name of the nudist colony reflected in the windshield of the car.
That's cool. I didn't know that. I mean, I know it was part of what we watched, but I must have missed that part.
I'll pick up the little details.
That's good, though. So finished, the group already had an international media sensation following their exploits in the States, and they were set for their UK debut.
Well, fuck yeah, go to the UK.
Now, a packed press corps met Wendy at Heathrow Airport, where, having changed into a nurse's uniform on the plane, she told the UK press corps that she had come to, quote-unquote, give a cultural enema to the British people.
Yeah, they might need it.
Yeah. Now, the planned debut show at London's Hammersmith
Odeon.
It sold out way in advance. And where Wendy was set to blow up another car, it never happened. Labeling her as an anarchist, the Greater London Council met in an emergency session and banned the show at the last minute. And amidst sensational headlines in all of the papers, the band returned to the United States, where a month after the album was released, they began a sold-out North American tour. A classic
band in the UK.
Yeah, band in the UK. A classic in its genre, the album charted in the UK, where the chainsaw anthem Butcher Baby went into the top 40 charts.
Which is pretty amazing, considering they weren't even allowed to play there.
Yeah, and it just took everything by demand. Now, by the time Metal Priestess was recorded and released in 1981, Wendy was a cultural icon. And the Plasmatics' second album, Beyond the Valley of 1984, had been released following a show at the Palms nightclub in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Wendy was arrested on supposed obscenity charges for allegedly simulating a sex act with a sledgehammer. Once she was outside the club, she was thrown to the ground and beaten into semi-consciousness.
Rod was also dragged off behind a car and beaten to unconsciousness when he attempted to come to her aid. Both were then taken to a hospital in ambulances and later thrown in jail. Others were arrested as well, on lesser charges, and even more people were threatened with arrest in an effort to keep people from seeing what was going on. Bail was raised, but there were now mammoth legal bills to pay, and the actual threat of jail should a jury take the word of police over Wendy and Rod. But fortunately, a local photographer had been able to photograph Wendy being beaten, and this refuted the claims of the police.
And several of the actual crowd came out and were like, no, we were there. We saw what happened. They beat the shit out of this woman who wasn't resisting. And there's photographic proof. And the police are pigs.
Yeah. Now, there was a show in Cleveland the next night. But with Wendy and Rod being in jail, the show could not go on. So it was rescheduled, however, for the following night when, again, Wendy was arrested. Thankfully, she wasn't assaulted this time as she had been in Milwaukee. However, the legal bills continued to mount. Still recovering from a broken nose, ruptured sinuses, and other injuries, within 12 days, Wendy and the band were playing in front of a sold-out crowd in Milan at the beginning of a three-week European tour, which saw her blowing up a Mercedes on the German Muscadelin TV show, and which subsequently caused riots in Zurich. Now, by the time the band reached Berlin, Rod, along with agent Jim Cramer and Bruce Kirkland, had actually organized the first of what would be three historic shows at Bonn's International Casino in Times Square as part of an effort to raise additional funds to offset legal fees that they were now incurring. The show had been to be launched with little time for promotion, but word of mouth spread, and fans lined up in the beginning of the early mornings in a bitter New York cold with some 2,000 people beyond the legal capacity packed in like sardines for the first Wendy Will Win show in New York City. The crowd cheered as the show opened with Wendy bursting through a giant banner brandished with a crossed out swastika that said, "Stop the Gestapo." Obviously referring to the Milwaukee police. And they also played their new song, Pig is a Pig, once again dedicated to the Milwaukee police and fascists everywhere. So, of course, with all this popularity, a second album was well overdue. So, along came Beyond the Valley, with songs like Master Plan, Pig is a Pig, and Sex Junkie. After shooting the epic album cover for Beyond the Valley in the Arizona desert, where Wendy appears on horseback with the band, or referred to it as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, she had to go back to Cleveland for a trial there. Protesters lined up on Wendy's behalf, and Wendy grabbed headlines criticizing Cleveland's district attorney for being a prosecutor of the case. He was, quote-unquote, flushing the taxpayers' money down the toilet because he's either afraid of the real criminals or paid off by them.
Bold statement.
Yes, and the prosecutor told the jury, "This woman has gone too far. It's time for you to draw the line." But after deliberations, they went on into the next day, however. They brought back a not guilty verdict to a cheering courtroom. Touring continued with repeated attempts by local authorities to shut shows down, which in some cases they managed to do. Now, reporter Lance Evans expressed it succinctly in the second PA Sunday Times when he wrote, "When the Plasmatics were booked to come to a town Saturday night, there were two chief fears. One was that due to their ongoing legal troubles centered around recurrent charges, and amid that, the performers wouldn't show up. And the second was that they would show up."
Yeah.
Now, Scranton's director of public safety, who's also quoted in some papers saying he hit the roof when he found out the details of the concert, and announced to the town's entire police department to stand by during the concert. So they go play this concert, and it's like, fucking deviants are trying to play in our city.
It's Scranton. What do you want?
I mean, yeah, it's Scranton. Now, Wendy and the band were booked into Bonn's for another two-night sold-out stand. where she blew up two Milwaukee police cars, and then back onto the Tom Snyder Show, where she blew up a car again during the song Master Plan, and then it was back to where? Milwaukee.
Oh, shit.
Now, the trial began on June 3rd, 1981 in the Circuit Court in Milwaukee County, which we kind of talked about this, but I think the details of the case are important as far as how things happen. So I definitely threw this in there. Let's see. So again on June 3rd. Sorry, I lost my place. Now, the DA wanted to get out from under the intense scrutiny of the media that had been on the case to that point and felt that they tried Wendy and Rod separately and they were going to try Rod first, that the media would lose interest. But it failed. The trial was still constructed as the Wendy O. / Plasmatics trial, and the media was there in full force. Fans came in from more than 2,000 miles away, and it was standing room only in the courtroom. The trial lasted over 1.5 weeks. Wendy's testimony was strong, and when the jury saw a full-color blow-up of her being beaten on the ground, it couldn't have failed to create a shocking impression. Courageous citizens who witnessed the event came forward, crucially, too. And after days and days of testimony, the jury deliberated only 3.5 hours and came back with that not guilty verdict.
Woo!
Now, of course, the DA had already decided if they couldn't get a conviction against Rod, he'd just drop the charges against Wendy. So it was a victory all around. As he's like, well, fuck.
Which is weird. I mean, like, I'd expect that from some, like, podunk town. But Milwaukee, you know better. Yeah, disappointed in you, Milwaukee.
Milwaukee's like a smaller Chicago.
I know.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's in the Midwest, but it's got, tries to have some culture.
Yeah. They get our runoff when it comes to concerts. I've gone to a couple of shows in Milwaukee because it was too expensive or too sold out to go in Chicago. You can just sneak up there 90 miles, an hour and a half, and get to go see the show in relative comfort.
Yeah. Now, the 1984, before we get started, we're going to...
Cheers.
Cheers. That there's some sip of whiskey.
Hmm.
Now, of course, the world tour continued with the bold slogan, "Down on your knees and pledge allegiance," through city after city, from Lagerman's Hall in San Francisco, Golden Hall in San Diego, and then back into L.A. Market to Perkins Palace for 4 consecutive nights with a car blown up every
Perkins Palace
night.
In Pasadena.
Perkins Palace in Pasadena. Say that again, faster.
Perkins Palace in Pasadena.
Now, during the last part of the tour, Rod had been contracted by music wunderkind Dan Hartman's office, and asking Dan, he decided he wanted to have a meeting with them. Like, he was contracted to do some stuff for them. He heard the album, and like Hartman, who first came to the public's attention with his teenage bass playing for Edgar Winter Group and writer of such classics like Frankenstein and others, like, he listened to it and he's like, he couldn't stop playing it.
He's like, I want to be a part of this.
He was like, it's groundbreaking. He's like, I knew I wanted to meet these people and do something with them. Dan came down to the Tribeca loft, met Wendy and Rod, and a month later, he and Rod were working on the production of the Metal Priestess EP. Now, the band needed more product, but another album was premature, partly because Capitol Records was now making overtures for the next one, and Bruce at Stiff was ready to release the EP that summer. Metal Priestess was recorded at Dan's private studio off of his schoolhouse turned into a studio in Connecticut and released early that fall. It includes such favorites as The Doom Song and Black Leather Monster, as well as 12 Noon. Then it was back on the road in September, where Wendy and the band closed the season of New York's Dr. Pepper Festival and then continued through January. So it's like everything they did was just a fucking whirlwind.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, that's how you keep popularity, though, as a band. You just keep getting yourself out there. And there was such like fervor for their live shows that like it was so important for them to keep doing it.
Yeah.
Because they were going to sell out every time they set their feet on the stage.
Because like a Plasmatic show wasn't just a show. It was an experience.
Yeah, it was an art installation with music, basically.
Yeah.
So, and they were doing a lot of stuff before anybody else ever thought to.
Yeah. Now, we're going to go back a little bit to 1982. I kind of jump around, so. But by the spring of 1982, a worldwide deal was inked with Capitol Records, and Dan Hartman offered to produce a demo on the album for Capitol with Rod at Electric Lady Studios, which was Jimi Hendrix's old studios in New York. Now, the whole album was arranged, recorded, and mixed within a week. And in the meantime, Dieter Dierks, who had just come off a number of albums with the Scorpions, also expressed interest in producing. Capitol felt that the buzz around Dierks would be better than the chores that went with him. So the Hartman demo was rediscovered and released 20 years later under the name Coupe de Grace, with Capitol Records releasing it in 82 as Coupe d'Etat. Coup d'etat, sorry. Now, the French guy can't even pronounce it.
Coup d'etat.
Coup d'etat. Now, the rawness in Coup de Grace, which took less than a tenth of the time and probably a 20th of the budget, had been lauded by many, although Coup d'etat was certainly a landmark album on its own. Coup was a breakthrough album that, quote-unquote, forced, in Chris Knoll's words, two groups together, namely punks and metalheads, who otherwise despised each other.
I mean, that's the, like, mentality I grew up with. When I was a kid, you were either a punk or you were a metalhead. And the two shall not meet.
No.
And they were the first band, or one of the first bands anyway, to take those two groups and tell them, hey, you both like it loud, you both like it angry, maybe y'all should get along.
Touch hands! Now, the political and Orwellian themes, which would become popular in avant metal later, although typically in watered-down form, were not being heard at the time. In addition, there were simply no women singing hard and heavy the way that Wendy did. In fact, she pushed her vocals so hard that she had to make trips into Cologne in Germany, where the record was being recorded, each day for treatments to avoid permanent damage to her vocal cords.
Ow.
Yeah, so she's just pushing, just to make this album what it was. Now, the reviews made the point, though. The LA Times called Coup d'Etat the best...
Coup d'Etat, sorry.
I'm gonna fuck this up. But the Coup d'Etat, the best slice of heavy metal since the last AC/DC album. Adding that Williams makes Ann Wilson and Pat Benatar sound like Judy Collins.
Oh,
okay. Bro, them's fighting words. We talk about these types of things. You just don't say these kinds of things. It's not polite.
Well, one thing about Wendy Williams, she was not polite.
By any means. So, Capitol had agreed to put up a very modest sum of money for Rod to produce and direct a video. But the video that Wendy and Rod had in mind would not be modest, either in its symbolism, logistics, or danger. Now, the video of The Damned would feature Wendy driving a school bus through a wall of TVs, climbing onto the roof of the moving bus, which had been loaded with explosives, and then singing from the roof and jumping off just a few moments before the bus goes through a second wall of TVs and then blows sky high.
And I gotta tell you, this is the image I've always had of Wendy O. Williams. When I was a kid, I remember seeing that video and not knowing what it was. I never actually put the two and two together until much later. But it leaves an indelible mark in your brain when you see it, especially as a kid. And you're like, holy shit, what did I just see?
This, yeah. So during a run through the jump off the bus, Wendy actually sprained her ankle, and it looked like the shoot might have actually been canceled. But the only time that Wendy ever canceled anything was when she was either in jail or unconscious. and canceling was not a choice from her point of view. She quote-unquote said, put the tape around it, and when she instructed one of the crew members. So her ankle was firmly taped with gaffer's tape, and the shoot went on. Now...
she basically said to them, you know what? Let's make having gaffer's tape wrapped around my ankle the next fashion statement. I don't care. I'm getting this on tape.
And it did.
Yep.
Now, before the premiere, however, MTV's legal department was getting cold feet. And so was the record company. And they both insisted that Rod put a warning at the beginning of the video that warned the audience not to try anything like this at home. The warning was added, and the video premiered. But it was poorly promoted and put into extremely light rotation. And promptly, within a few weeks, it was pulled.
Because they're wusses. They couldn't handle it. No. Couldn't handle the truth.
You can't handle the truth. Now, in the meantime, as the tour started itself, it was starting to clear that it was coming very clear that Capitol was running in the other direction. And at the time the album was released, the record company had effectively made up their mind to drop the group. Now, in the meantime, Kiss... Gene Simmons from Kiss had asked for Wendy and the Plasmatics to appear as special guests on their tour. Now, Kiss wanted the controversial street edge that Wendy would bring as part of their tour, and for the Plasmatics, it was a chance to play in front of different audiences in different markets than they would ordinary play. So the answer was yes, with the result that a lot of people were exposed to something they'd never seen. By the end of the tour, Kiss, it was clear that their relationship, however, with Capitol was done. And legal battles thus ensued as a contract with Capitol was slowly dismantled. Now, while all this is going on, Gene Simmons had actually approached Wendy and Rod about producing the next Wendy O album. So, as to avoid any wasted time in legal issues with Capitol, it was decided not to use the Plasmatics' name on the record at all. It made no difference to Gene. In fact, he felt it would give him freedom, and he wanted to add new players to the album. So he's like, cool, I get to play with this. This is going to be fun. Now, a common error that is sometimes found in poorly researched articles on the band of the Plasmatics, people say that at this time they broke up in 1983. But according to the official website where I got most of my information for this show, that's false. To Rod and Wendy, there was never an actual band to break up. The Plasmatics was a name created by Rod for the concept band of changing musicians built around Wendy. There were always one to two members changing with every recording, and there was no difference here. It was simply a choice by Wendy and Rod not to use the Plasmatics name on the album. And I've seen a lot of that. We're like, yeah. Oh, well, this is when the Plasmatics broke up. And I mean, the Plasmatics were more of a concept. Than a band?
You can't really, like, break up a concept if the two people with the concept are still doing it. And they kept their lead guitarist, so in, like, concept and feel and creative ability, the Plasmatics were always the Plasmatics. It was just whatever group that they had, or, like, supporting Wendy at any given time.
Now, for the recording, Gene Simmons actually played bass under the pseudonym of Reginald Van Helsing.
Of course he did.
And he brought in other members of Kiss and a whole slew of talent to put together the record. It was then released through Passport Gem, who had just had an injunction of with Capitol under the WOW label. Gem had agreed to put up funds for a video, which several of the other labels, who also made offers on the album, did not. Now, when review copies were sent out to the various media outlets, it was the Kerrang! Magazine review that Wendy, Rod, and everyone else was patiently waiting for. Malcolm Dome had picked the WOW album as his album of the year.
Which is insane. Like, huge. He was the metal, like, review god at the time.
Yeah.
Whatever he said to the metal community, they took his word. So they were making sure that he liked it. Obviously he made it his album of the year. It just went huge.
Yeah, it went like what we would equate to like modern day as just viral, right?
Yeah.
Now, later, Wendy actually got a Grammy nomination as Best Female Rock Vocalist of the Year for her vocals on the album, which was completely remarkable achievement for someone who had completely thumbed her nose at the establishment and whom radio on a large scale just refused to play her. They're like, I don't know, man. That's some heavy shit.
And this is why, as influential as she was to the people that we all look up to, so many people didn't know who she was even in this day and age, because they were not allowed to be played on MTV. They pretty much got shoved in a corner by them, and they weren't being played on modern radio. Nobody wanted to touch them. But the people who knew music, the people who were the tastemakers for the time, they knew who she was.
Yeah.
And they were the ones who supported Wendy when nobody else, like, when it wasn't reaching the masses, it was hitting hard in the actual scene. So,
yeah, I mean, so moving on to the next part, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when Wendy decided to cut her hair into a mohawk, she did it because nobody else was doing it. She brought the mohawk to mainstream punk and metal.
Yeah.
Now, however, by this time, mohawks were starting to become common. So she decided to grow her hair in. And on the cover of what would be called the Album of the Year in the pages of Kerrang, it was very opposite of the early covers. Total simplicity. In contrast, however, the video was to be perhaps the most dangerous Wendy had ever done. The first part of the video was shot in LA at the Olympic Arena with Wendy wrestling two female wrestlers, but it was the next part which got the most attention, and for which the crew was again assembled in the Arizona desert. Now, in this one...
Ding.
Oops, fries are done. Wendy would attempt a transfer from a moving car to an airplane with a rope ladder with no safety harness. She just fucking refused it. Now, the heat in the desert that day made it much more dangerous and difficult to get a lift for the plane. Multiple runs were done, and ace pilot Chuck Wentworth and Rod and the cameraman were in radio communication. Finally, the ladder landed in just the right place for Wendy to grab it and being able to hold on to it. Everyone held their breath. They seemed to remember that for the next 8 minutes, while she held onto the ladder dangling from the plane, that the car, driverless, careened off a cliff and exploded, and Wendy was able to climb up into the plane.
All of this with no CGI. There is literally a car going off a cliff that a woman had been driving a minute earlier, and she was dangling from a ladder on a plane. Like, most stunt people couldn't do that. They said one or two, like, TV shows had tried something similar, and that was always done by stuntmen, and it was always done with safety harnesses. She is the first person to do it with no backup effects and to do it on her own.
Yeah, I mean, Wendy was just like, badass. Go big or go home.
Yeah, she wasn't gonna, like, mess around with it. She was like, I'm either gonna do this or I'm gonna die trying.
Yeah. I mean, that's just... But, in the meantime, material for the next album was accruing. Rod produced the album, and Wes came in as an associate producer and worked on writing, arranging, and recording, but the recording would be Michael, TC, and Greg Smith. Now, the touring band for this album would be stripped down to a three-piece, which is what they had initially wanted the band to be, a three-piece. And there was a tremendous excitement in tackling the project in a kind of minimalist, stripped-down concept, or rite of purification, is what they kind of called it. Now, the songs, including the lyrics, would also be minimalized or archetypical again, giving Wendy a chance to take her vocals one step further. Contrary to the tempo of the Well album, which had actually been slowed down than the previous albums in an effort to open it up, the new album, Commander of Chaos, or KOK, was to bring back the speed of some of the earliest albums and then some. Now, a white Cadillac Eldorado appeared again on the Commander of Chaos album, as it had on the first one, New Hope, only this time seen crashing through a wall with Wendy riding the hood. I mean, they're like, nah, I mean, we'll take it back, but we're going to take it back and give it balls.
Yeah.
More balls than before. I mean, it had balls before, but these are like gigantic, like, they're having a ball off, folks. They're having a ball off. So we've been actually watching the new Paradise PD episodes.
I'm not proud of that.
I love Paradise PD. It's
something good to watch when you have no, like, brain power left to watch anything else.
I mean, it's garbage, but it's good. It's hot garbage, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Now, having laid down what Chris Knowles of Classic Rock would call Wendy's most extreme vocals ever, and the album in the can, but not yet released, Wendy and the band flew to London to perform at the Camden Palace for a TV show live from London, which would broadcast throughout Europe. 30 days later, Commander of Chaos was released worldwide. Wendy had done a part for the film Reform School Girls that was now in post-production. Neither she nor Rod really liked the film much, but when it came out, they saw it once and never looked at it again, but at this point, the producers had heard Commander of Chaos and wanted to include three of the tracks from the album in the movie score. They also approached Rod about producing a title track for the film and having Wendy sing it. The song was not something that he or the band would have written or Wendy would have ordinarily sung, but it was an up-tempo song, and under the circumstances, they agreed to do it. So Uncle Brian, musician, producer, and owner of The Brock, joined Rod as a co-producer and also played the sax. He also appeared in the video that the film company had asked Rod to produce and direct, playing the saxophone and wearing a tutu. I mean, why the fuck not? So that's something that I haven't talked about yet, but a lot of the shows, even from the early shows, would include a lot of cross-dressing.
Yes.
So they'd make the guys, like, even if, like, so originally, the band would perform with, like, Wendy in a nurse's outfit and all the bandmates dressed as, like, doctors or nursing people.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of...
Eventually, some of the guys wore the nurse's outfits. Sometimes they wore tutus. And it was just another way of, like, thumbing their nose at the establishment. Because back then, cross-dressing was considered a subversive act.
Yeah. Now, the video itself consisted of live footage shot of Wendy singing the song at the Ritz in New York City, cut with scenes from the movie. The next album, Maggots the Record, was recorded in 1987 and set 25 years in the future, where environmental abuse and the burning of fossil fuels has created a greenhouse effect. That then leads to an end-of-the-world scenario. Called by many as the first thrash metal opera, the album also featured dialogue of a hapless white family through 3 days of their lives until one by one they met their ends as the record moves towards its final scene, where effectively the entire human population is headed by an inanimate annihilation at the hands of giant maggots.
Which, you know, gross. But it was their thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was their shtick. Now, the album was released through Profile Records under the WOW label in the U.S. and overseas by GWR Records, Fun by Doug Smith. Now, Wendy did a performance piece to inaugurate the album in New York City's Palladium, which had been transformed from the theater that it was into a huge multi-level club where she sledgehammered and chainsawed it to smithereens as an all-American living room. And Maggots the Tour began a week later using the Plasmatics name for the first time in two albums with slogans such as, "Those now eating will soon be eaten," "The day of a human is gone," and lyrics such as, "Soldiers for the DNA descendants are put away, dragged off into the dead of night, disappearing without a sight. Just part of the chilling prophecy of the album, which returned to many of the major political Aurelian themes, including environmental disaster, abuse, and decay, for which the Plasmatics were known. Now, the review in Kerrang! Came out shortly after, and it was the highest possible rating that you could get in Kerrang! A 5 out of 5 Ks. Quite simply a masterpiece, a work of genius. And Wendy's vocals were referred to as reduced to Celtic Frost's Tom G. Warrior's death grunts to mere whimpers. Maggots the record is indispensable. Now, during the tour, rear screen projectors ran films on human disasters, fascists, and other historical horrors. Environmental carnage and human rights violations on huge screens behind the band during all the songs from the Maggots album. So it's like, they didn't just play the album, but they put some fucked up shit behind them.
Which other bands would eventually catch up and start doing. But like, again,
Rage Against the Machine.
Right. I mean, you know, Nine Inch Nails. They all kind of took that theme. But again, it's stuff that they were doing before anybody else was. And they don't get the credit for it, which is another reason why we are bringing this to you. Because it's all about giving credit where credit is due, yep. Knowing your history. And that's one of the biggest things about music is, like, people hear stuff now and they don't know where it came from.
No, they're just like, yeah, this is so awesome.
You know?
What is this?
Yeah. And, you know, people are doing stuff and people are like, oh, they must have thought of that. That's brilliant. And, you know, people doing it now are doing it well. Or people who have done it for the last 20 years. But they learned it from somewhere.
And this is where they learned it from.
Exactly.
So, before we get into the real heavy shit, towards the end of the Plasmatics, I'm going to take this moment to say thank you for being here with us. I'm also going to, for the first time ever, try this Polish beer. How do you say this?
I don't know.
Zwajak?
Zwajak?
Sorry. Yeah. So I'm going to try this. We're going to see how this goes. I've been waiting to try it. But we live in a predominantly, like, Polish neighborhood. So it's like, and Chicago is like second Poland.
It has more people in Chicago. It's the second highest population of Polish people outside of Warsaw.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. We're going to try it.
I'm just watching.
Oh. It's pleasant. It's, like, easy to drink, and there's, like, no aftertaste. It kind of filters nice.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean, like, else. I couldn't get a hold of my PBR extras, so I was like, I'll just buy one of their tall boys and try it, and it's not half bad. You want to try it?
Not right now.
She's like, no.
I've been drinking cider. I'm good.
Yeah, that's actually really good. All right, cool. So, Wendy next released a thrash rap album called Deafest and Baddest. The album, which was the last of 7 full studio albums that make up Wendy O's and the Plasmatics' career, was never intended in its original concept to have Wendy or the Plasmatics' name on it at all. The artist is listed as Ultrafly and the Hometown Girls, an imaginary fictitious group that was part of the concept. The whole album, designed to be a fresh and spontaneous as kind of a blurt, was written in about a week and recorded and mixed in 2.
It was a lark. Because who takes a punk metal goddess and makes her rap?
Yeah, so. But it allowed Wendy to do a few things that she wanted to do and hadn't done, which included bringing in a female guitarist who played alongside West Beach and use female voices for backup.
Okay.
Now, the guitarist that she used was Katrina Astrin, who was a guitarist from the Wisconsin all-girl hardcore band The Hunted.
Nice.
Yeah, so they brought her in to do it. Now, for the Deafest tour, the band was back to two guitars, bass, and drums, since all of the tours always contained favorites from the previous records. The tour was filled with enthusiastic fans in city after city, but it was the last tour that Wendy and the Plasmatics were to do, although the decision wasn't made until several weeks later, after the tour ended, and then it was made fairly quickly.
Okay.
Now, Wendy and Rod had agreed from the beginning that when a point came where diminishing returns meant having to compromise the integrity of the effort, they'd shut it down and bail out. And at this point, they felt it had been reached, or at least was too close to gamble. The funds were not there to take all of these things on, and with a widening gap between tour bookings, particularly in the heartlands of the country, it was at a point where to continue would have meant compromise in one or many of the other ways of another. So it was like, they're like, I mean, there was never an option. So in 1988, it was officially announced that Wendy was going on hiatus. So you don't really hear much from Wendy, but you find out that her first attempted suicide was in 1993. And what she did is she hammered a knife into her chest where it lodged in her sternum. However, she changed her mind and called Rod to take her to the hospital. She attempted suicide again in 1997.
Hold on. I need a minute. She hammered a knife into her own chest.
Yes.
Okay. That's hardcore.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Ouch.
Carry on, because that's fucked up.
I mean, that's just like, holy shit. Now, she attempted it again in 97 with an overdose on ephedrine. But then on April 6, 1998, Rod returned to their home and found a package that Wendy had left for him that contained some noodles that he liked, a packet of seeds for growing garden greens, and some oriental massage balm sealed with letters from her. The suicide letters, which included a quote-unquote living will denying life support, was a love letter to Rod and a various list of things to do, which caused Rod to begin searching the woods for her. After about an hour, as dusk fell, he found her body in a wooded area with a pistol lying on the ground nearby. She had apparently been feeding some wild squirrels moments before her suicide. She put a bag over her head before shooting herself to spare her partner the horrible sight.
And also, I want to take a minute to say, she and Rod had been partners for 20 years at this point and had never talked about it. They kept their relationship completely private, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until they were living together peacefully in the woods of Connecticut on their own that anybody even knew they were a couple.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, the whole time they were together, they just never publicized it.
Exactly. Which, again, amazing in these days and age that somebody could hide that for that long.
Now, this decision, which she reportedly wrote in a suicide note regarding her decision, was, "I don't believe that people should take their own lives without deep and thoughtful reflection over a considerable period of time. I do believe strongly, however, that the right to do so is one of the most fundamental rights that anyone in a free society should have. For me, much of the world makes no sense, but my feelings about what I'm doing ring loud and clear to an inner ear in a place where there is no self, only calm." Stars like Joey Ramone and many others issued statements at the time of her death. On Motorhead's 1999 live album Everything Louder Than Everyone Else, before the song No Class, Motorhead vocalist Lemmy said that he wanted to dedicate the song to her. A memorial was held at CBGB on May 18th. Several of Wendy's former Plasmatic co-members played a six-song set, with four of them handling the vocals. Wendy O. Williams was 48 years old.
It gives me chills still, because I owe Wendy a big apology. I went into this not knowing much about her personal life, and she was so hardcore that she was basically a stick figure of muscle and bone her entire life. And by the end, she looked pretty wrecked.
Yeah, I mean, by modern standards, we'd have been like, was she doing meth? We don't know.
Right. She was like that beach blonde, lived out in the sun, way too wiry, like leathery kind of look to her. And my entire life, I thought she was a drug addict. I thought that she ended up ODing and was living that hardcore rock and roll lifestyle. What I did not know is that she never was a drinker or a drug user. She was a vegetarian the entire time. She worked out religiously, and her depression was just her own, and it had nothing to do with substance abuse. And to that, I apologize to you, Wendy O. Williams. I did not know, and I assumed, and I apologize for that. Once again, because we are tackling another subject that does end in suicide, unfortunately, I want to remind our listeners that, you know, while it is a personal decision, it affects everybody around you. And we do not condone suicide.
No.
And we urge you that if you are having suicidal thoughts or ideation, get help. And you can always call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. So if you don't feel like reaching out to them, find a friend, find a family member, talk to us. We will help you get help. It's all about knowing yourself and knowing that there is help out there for you, because there's a reason to go on.
Yep.
So in the meantime, fucking live your life like Wendy Williams, man. Give the world the fucking finger. Do what you want. Speak your mind. Do it healthily and fucking own the world for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I know that there is another individual that we're planning on talking about, but I feel like Wendy O. Williams' music career was a lot like his career. And he's someone that we admire, and a lot of people didn't understand him. And I feel like it's the same. Like, Wendy O. Williams is the Anthony Bourdain of cooking. Like, he was an all-out punk. He was all out against the society that he grew up in his career. And he just took it to the max, and he traveled, and he lived his life full. And then when he felt like it was his time to go, he went. I mean, we don't condone suicide by any means whatsoever. Like, his death still rocks people's lives.
Including mine.
Yeah, like, we are watching Ugly Delicious, and like,
which we love, by the way.
Yeah, and like, when his good friend who runs the show, David Chang, found out that his wife was pregnant, it rocked his world, because he had, once Anthony passed away,
it had been like within a week of Anthony's passing, and he didn't know if he wanted to bring another life into this world at that time. He didn't know he could feel fatherly at a time where he felt like he had been losing touch with like one of his best friends in the world. So,
but he also talked about when his son was getting ready to be born that he had never considered anything like reincarnation. I feel like if Anthony was gonna come back, he would come back as an attitude-based Korean man.
As a fat little Korean baby?
Yeah.
To be raised by David Chang?
Yeah, whose, like, dad is, like, a well-known, absolutely phenomenal chef.
Yes.
Who is trying to bring Asian food and culture into the light that we embrace French food or
Italian food.
Italian food
The
specifically. And
debate over Italian noodles versus Asian noodles and dumplings.
well, it wasn't even noodles. It was just Italian stuffed pasta versus Asian stuffed pasta.
Yeah, it
And
was brilliant.
yeah.
And yes, I'm saving up to do an Anthony Bourdain episode because it means so much to me that I can't fuck it up. But I have some ideas as to where I want to go next with this. This series seems to be doing really well for us. We never intended to be like the Dead Rockstars podcast, but we've gotten so much positive feedback on this, and we're so knowledgeable about music that it's become almost inevitable. And it's not going to become what we do permanently. We'll come back and forth from it, but we're on a series right now. I have another episode in mind for next week that I think I'm going to run point on. So I'm kind of looking forward to it. It kind of came to me while we were doing this, and I think there's some people out there who will really be interested in it. So stick with me, and I'll debut my thoughts on that in a couple days. But let us know if there's anybody you want us to talk about. We're open.
Yeah, I think we initially started this podcast as to be kind of like a true crime spooky podcast, but covering dead rock stars seems to kind of work for us,
Yeah,
but
it comes certain seems to be our niche, and people are really liking that. And we've gotten good feedback on the Instagram. Please feel free to write us there. Feel free to write us on our Gmail account, dietblack@gmail.com, or hit us up on the Facebook group, and we will totally listen to what you have to
oh,
say,
yeah.
and we will be happy to discuss it with you. And stay tuned for further episodes of what we're going to bring you, because I think we've got some cool stuff up our sleeves.
Yes, and we're excited to do this. Like, I mean, it's not our bread and butter, but it's our mental bread and butter.
It's what we talk about at home. So really that's kind of what this season's been all about. We talk about Tiki at home. We talk about weird Alice in Wonderland shit at home. And we talk about dead rock stars. So,
Yeah, I mean, I'm even fine doing a rock star that may not be passed
Yeah,
yet.
exactly. It's we're about the music, and that's always been a driving force for us. It's one of the
Music,
things that brought us together.
movies, creepy, weird shit.
Yeah, and we want to share that with you. So let us know what you're into. You've got our contact info, and in the
Yes.
meantime,
Remember? To Diet Black.
Diet Black, good night.